Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. My guest, Etan Thomas, was a basketball star at Syracuse and then spent more than a decade in the NBA with the Wizards, Thunder, and Hawks.
Number four, that's him getting away from Shumpert, gives it back to Sales, and what a swat by Thomas.
But basketball has only been part of his focus. A social justice advocate, writer, interviewer, and media commentator, Thomas's latest book is called Police Brutality and White Supremacy: The Fight Against American Traditions. The book covers Thomas's own experiences with discrimination in America and how it has affected his family. And it gathers sometimes difficult conversations he's had with star athletes, police, media figures, and more. Etan Thomas, welcome to the Roundtable.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I was just wondering, you know, this is not your first book, and you've been talking about a lot of these issues for many years. Where did you get your sense of right and wrong and justice from?
I think it kind of developed a little bit in middle school in Tulsa, Oklahoma, Carver Middle School. That's where it first started for me, and that's what I went back to in this book. I went back to the Rodney King verdict and, you know, really being aware of there's something different going on in society when everything, you know, that was back before cell phones. You know, young people don't remember those times, but we didn't have cell phones where we could just look at things or look things up all the time, YouTube and anything like that. So that was really my first time seeing the video of Rodney King being beaten. That was my first really experience. And then to see all the police officers get off, I remember it so vividly. So I go through it in the book. And I wanted to go back and talk with people who were there. So I reached out to Rodney King's daughter, Lorna Dean King, and I reached out to Isaiah Thomas, who was there also around that time period, and Craig Hodges, and we just spoke about it, what was going on. And that's what I really wanted to do with all of the chapters, just go by, you know, topic by topic and have a discussion with other people and have them weigh in and give their perspectives, give their experiences, give their opinions. And that's just how I developed the entire book.
It's striking how much different your experience of hearing about what happened to Rodney King was from your own children later when they heard about George Floyd, which was, you know, taken and loaded to social media instantaneously, and the whole world got to see it. And before you even had a chance to kind of prepare how you would talk to your kids about it, they'd already heard about the video.
Yeah, that's the difference in, you know, technology. I mean, you know, back in my day, back in the early 90s, we didn't have all that. You know, there was no social media. There was no looking things up. We had to go to the library if we wanted to look something up. You know, kids now don't even know what microfiche is. They have no need for that. So that's what we had to do. But now, yeah, now with the spread of information, you know, you're seeing things kind of, you know, instantaneously when they happen. And young people are aware a lot more, I would say, than we were when we were their age, because we didn't see all of that. Now, sometimes that could be good and bad, you know, positive and negative to that. But yeah, young people are just more aware.
Black people have to think about giving the talk to their kids. It's something that you went through with your grandparents, and it's something you've dealt with as a father. Do you remember when you first kind of were aware that, you know, police might treat you differently if you ran into them?
Oh, yeah, that was eighth grade. You know, everything was after the Rodney King verdict. You know, I remember very, very vividly having the discussions at school. You know, back then we had something called the DARE program. I don't know if they still have that. But they would, you know, there were a police officer, almost like Officer Friendly, would come in and he would talk to us. And I remember the conversations drastically changed after that happened. I think another instance that I remember, and I, you know, because I was born in Harlem, but then I moved to Tulsa, Oklahoma. And it was a few years before that with the Central Park Five. And I was actually in Harlem, you know, when that happened. And I talk about that in the book as well. I actually got the chance to speak to Raymond Santana of the now exonerated Five, and speak to him directly, you know, for the book. But yeah, I remember that as well. I remember my grandmother having to talk with me about how things were different. I mean, they were, you know, it was kind of like writing the book. It was kind of like reliving, you know, kind of traumatization, because I was really traumatized by it, to be honest with you, because you when you're young, you know, it's totally different. You know, you watch the cops on TV and it's, you know, the cops are the good guys and, you know, it's just totally different. But then when you have a situation happen like a Rodney King or a Central Park Five, it's like a rude awakening that things are different for you. And so, you know, that's why I really covered that in the book.
And when the Central Park Five case happened, you were at the basketball court as police in New York City were looking to arrest suspects in the case. And you got separated from your grandfather, as I understand it. Seems like you had a close call that day.
I really did. And the thing about it is, you know, I was taller. So although I was young, I looked like I was a teenager, but I wasn't a teenager, you know. You know, that was a really experience where I didn't really know what was going on, but, you know, my grandparents did, and just seeing everything. So when I watched the movie, the docuseries, I think it's called, When They See Us.
Yeah. Ava DuVernay. Yep.
Ava DuVernay, with my kids, it was like, I was reliving. I was like, wow, I was there when that happened. You know what I mean? I'm like putting two and two together, you know, in the time period. And I'm making, you know, remembering different things that were happening. I remember when they was rounding up every black and brown teenager in Harlem at the time and rounding them up, you know what I mean? And taking them down. I remember when all that happened. So, yeah, you know, I mean, going through all of that, it's definitely a, you know, triggering process.
What did you tell your own children, and how did you decide, you know, when and how to talk to them about some of these issues?
Well, sometimes it was by accident. You know, my son Malcolm, he was young when he first saw about Trayvon Martin, and he saw it by accident. Like, I left the TV on, and he, you know, he came into the room.
And he was only 6 years old, right?
Right. He was six, and I was kind of forced to talk to him about it because he was asking so many questions. It definitely wasn't by choice. I wasn't planning on talking to him about it at 6 years old, but, you know, like I say, kids are just aware of more. And like you said, you know, after that, they're seeing what happened with George Floyd. Their friends are talking about it. You know, my daughter Imani was ready to go to this big rally in DC. It was in the height of COVID, you know, so we couldn't go, but she had already been talking with all her friends and already been talking about everything before I even got the chance to even talk to her about it. So, kids are just different these days.
You know, we're speaking just after the anniversary of the January 6th insurrection. So much of your book is about, you know, the integration of kind of right-wing extremism and white supremacy just into our national discourse and our national politics. What are you thinking about the legacy of the Capitol siege last year?
Oh, wow. Well, you know, for my book, I interviewed Jemele Hill and Jake Tapper from CNN. So we talked about it extensively. And, you know, with Jemele Hill, she made the point about the differences in the way it was handled versus how it would have been handled if all of the people who stormed the Capitol looked like me. And, you know, when you're going back to the talk, there's always this discussion of, you know, you can't do what your white counterparts do. You know, in school, you know, if you might see your white students do something, you can't do that. The punishment will be different. You know what I mean? That's just the way that things are. And seeing in the Capitol and seeing how they just, you know, they walked away. You know, they were being ushered down the stairs. Like, it was just, you know, we couldn't even think of doing anything like that. And Jemele Hill, she made a statement like, if we even had the thought bubble, like a meeting about doing something like that, the police would have been right there. You know, I mean, and it would have been different. This is something that's been around, you know, talked on throughout social media since the Capitol. Like, wow, could you imagine if we did that? Because we have had so many instances where we don't have any kind of anything. We, you know, when we have a cell phone, we have a wallet that the police officer asked us to take out, and we get shot, and all these different instances. So we couldn't imagine doing something like this. And, you know, and talking with Jake Tapper, you know, it was interesting because he came from a perspective of really holding other members of the media accountable for the way that they allowed a lie to prevail and kind of, you know, incite an entire demographic leading up to January 6th. And that's when I first, you know, I first saw him saying that, and that's what made me want to reach out to him, because you usually don't see too many members of the media calling out each other. It's like there's a special code. Like, they don't call out each other like that. You know, and of course you have, you know, the right versus left, but he wasn't saying that. He was like, all members, whoever falls into this category. So that's what made me want to reach out to him. And we talked a lot, you know, we talked a lot about, you know, Trump and what he did to kind of, you know, evoke the atmosphere that led up to the riots, everything that happened before that. I mean, it was a great discussion.
We're speaking with Etan Thomas. He's the former basketball player and the author of many books, including the new one, Police Brutality and White Supremacy, The Fight Against American Traditions. To pick up on something you just said, you have a section of this book about white allies and accomplices. What do you think white people who want to help the situation in America should be doing right now?
Well, I'll go from what, you know, Sue Bird said. And you know, it's really more first recognizing that there is a difference in treatment. There is a white privilege that does exist. And she talked a while about the resistance that, you know, usually comes when you talk about white privilege from white people. And this was her talking, and she's saying, well, yeah, a lot of white people think that, okay, this means that you didn't work hard, or you were just given everything. And she's like, no, I'm sure you worked hard. You know what I mean? It's just that certain things didn't happen to you because you were black. You have the privilege of being white for those things not to happen to you. And it's a concept that's kind of difficult to understand, you know, unless you're, you know, from what she was saying, she's, you know, had black teammates for so long, and they've sat down and explained to her and shared with her and everything like that. Kyle Korver, the same way, he expressed how, you know, he was actually doing a lot of self-examination as to why he should have known better, with a few different instances that happened where he automatically thought the worst of somebody who was close to him, in this case, his teammates. We talked about when Thabo Sefolosha had his leg broken by the NYPD, and his first thought was, oh, wow, what did Thabo do to get his leg broken? Mm-hmm. And then he saw the video, and then he saw all the facts come out, and he was like, well, wait a minute, why did I think that? Why didn't I think, you know, that the police could have been wrong? He was like, he was programmed to automatically think one way, and he knows Thabo, like that's his friend. So he was talking about it from that standpoint. So it was really, you know, both of them were saying that there's a lot of self-examination that needs to be done if you really want to be an ally, and they truly want to be one. You have to be honest with yourself that things are different in this country. And they said that was really the first step.
What do you think it means to act in an anti-racist way, or to be an anti-racist?
Well, you know, Angela Davis, you know, famously said, and I don't want to mess up the quote, but it was something to the effect of, you know, it's not enough to not be racist. You have to be anti-racism, or something like that. And there is a difference. You know, a lot of times, you know, things will happen, and, you know, white people will have the reaction, well, that doesn't apply to me. You know, I'm not racist. I don't have a, you know, racist bone in my body, certain kind of phrases that always get thrown around. But you're not actively doing anything to be against it, because it doesn't necessarily pertain to you. And that's, you know, that's across the board. Usually people are not, you know, more interested in topics that don't directly affect them. It's what happens. That's why politicians, they change what they talk, you know, how they present, depending on who they're speaking to. You know, that's just what happens. But there's something called empathy, where you can say that something is wrong, even if it doesn't directly affect you. It's still wrong that it affects this person over here, or it's the wrong that it is still, you know, and that's a part of trying to create that empathy. After George Floyd was murdered and the whole country saw it, you know, there was a moment where it was like an awakening for a while. And I don't know why, you know what I mean? Because there's plenty of different cases that were on video before, you know, but that one, I don't know if it was because we was in a pandemic and lockdown, or for whatever reason, that one really caught a lot of people's attention of saying that's wrong. And it's that level of empathy that, you know, that you want to create, that you can always say that something's wrong if it's unjust. you know, that it affects you, that it's not something that you could just turn the page to or click the channel from and not be affected.
So are you optimistic about our current situation, given the fact that, as you say, you know, a lot more people are or seem to be plugged into the idea of, you know, working toward justice in whatever form that it takes in the U.S. right now? But on the other hand, you know, we've seen some very ugly truths about our country in the last several years. So are you optimistic about where we are today?
You know, it's a tough question because you have times you're more optimistic and times when you're not. You know, I mean, now, right now, the day after January 6th insurrection, anniversary, and I'm looking at the news and I'm watching all the people justify it and, you know, downplay it and all, it really wasn't that bad and everything like that. I'm like, oh, really? You know, so that kind of makes you a little less optimistic when you see that. But then you see other people who are, you know, outraged by it still, you know, or were calling for different, you know, people who were complicit and, you know, on board with it and you know, but whether they're congressmen or senators or politicians or media, they're calling for them to be held accountable too, and they're denouncing it, and this is not who we are. So that makes you a little bit more optimistic. It kind of goes in waves, to be honest with you. You see a group of young people, you know, all standing up and saying that this is wrong, and you know, that, you know, this case of police brutality is wrong, and we don't stand for that, and we want to change, and, you know, talking about big groups of white people, then that makes you optimistic. But then, you know, you look at social media, and you see, like, a high school with, you know, Nazi signs on their chests, and, you know what I mean, dressed in blackface, and, you know, and you're like, oh, Lord, is this what our young people are doing? Mm. So it goes in waves, but I do know that this is a fight that's been a fight for decades. And, you know, I don't think we're going to solve it, you know what I mean, and eradicate racism. And you know, I think that's a little bit far-fetched. But, you know, it's a fight that's just going to be continuous. And it's been, you know, a fight for a long time. It's going to keep being a fight for a long time.
We haven't talked about sports much today, but you know, the NBA is kind of different in terms of its ability to affect the national discussion, in terms of how willing players are to take politics and situations like this head on and make a statement on things, maybe more so than the time you were in the league. Do you think that sports can play a role in this conversation?
Oh, definitely. You know, I mean, there's a lot of contributing factors to that, and I credit a lot with Adam Silver. He was a lot different than David Stern. You know, Adam Silver, I interviewed him for We Matter.
Yep, just for people who are listening, that's the current NBA commissioner.
Yeah, that's the current NBA commissioner. And David Stern is the former NBA commissioner. And, you know, Adam Silver is just, he's welcoming to athletes using their voices. He's, you know, I asked him point blank, would you punish someone who is, you know, using their voice on a topic that you disagree with? Because that's always the caveat. Anybody could applaud somebody who they agree with. The left does that and the right does that. You know what I mean? They, you know, somebody, an athlete stands up and they're talking to their positions, and then they applaud them. But then if an athlete's saying something that they disagree with, then that's when you get the shut up and dribble and stay in your lane and the personal criticism. And that happens on both the left and the right. I want to make that point very clear, because I'm completely against that, you know, no matter who does. But Adam Silver said he wouldn't do that. And that is the nature of most of the teams. So I interviewed, you know, coaches and players, and none of them felt – it's funny because when I actually was interviewing John Wall, and I said, you know, there's some organizations that would kind of, you know, not want you to speak about certain things. And he kind of giggled and laughed. He was like, really? Organizations do that? And it's so foreign to them. You know what I mean? I was like, yeah, there was a time when, you know, things were a lot different. So that's good to see. But the way that you see this new wave of activism and athletes using their voice, I honestly think is great.
What about in the college game? You were such a star in the Big East during your time. Now college players are slowly getting more equity in their battle with the NCAA. They have access to gain profit from their name, image, and likeness. And it seems that things are going in the direction of, you know, some sort of compensation for players who have been held to an amateur standard for many years. Do you think about, you know, how you might have existed in the college game if today's rules were applied to the time when you were at Syracuse?
Oh, of course. I mean, there was, you know, plenty of time. I remember when I was in high school reading the Fab Five book, And, you know, that's what really opened my eyes to the exploitation of the NCAA. When Chris Webber was talking about, you know, seeing his jersey, you know, being sold and looking up in the stands and seeing all of his jerseys up there, but he didn't get any money from it, you know. And I experienced that at Syracuse. I was like, huh, this is just what Chris Webber was saying. You know what I mean? Because, you know, you're a broke college student. You don't have any money. But you see all your jerseys being sold. You see posters. You do autograph signings. And you do benefits. And you raise all this money and all this different stuff happening. You're signing shoes and everything. And, you know, you don't get to participate in any of it. So, yeah, things are changing. And, you know, a lot of that as well is, you know, social media is different now. Because, you know, like even going back to the Fab Five days, they didn't have social media. So now athletes, when they're in college and they want to be able to speak out on a topic, they don't have to wait till the, you know, college beat writer speaks to them or something like that. They can go on their social media that they have, you know, thousands, sometimes maybe even hundreds of thousands of followers, and they can say whatever they want to say. And that's a lot of power. There's a lot of power in that. So, you know, I think that's great. I think it's great.
Do you have a favorite team to watch in the league now or a favorite player to follow?
Well, my son's favorite player is Giannis, so we watch a lot of him.
A lot of the Bucks games?
Yeah, a lot of the Bucks games. You know, everybody here in the DMV loves KD, so we've been watching a lot of KD, you know, no matter what team he's been on. You know, so I, you know, those years, now I watch differently. So I'm usually watching, you know, with my son, breaking stuff down, you know, like you're watching film. And we're studying the moves. And those are the people who we like to study the most. He also likes Kawhi Leonard a lot. But he's injured now, so we can't watch him. But, yeah, those are the three players.
Do your kids play?
Yeah, my son plays. He's a sophomore at DeMatha. And my daughters play volleyball. So we watch a lot of volleyball tape as well. So that's what I do nowadays.
And are you encouraging them to follow in your footsteps?
Well, to whatever they want to do. And, you know, as far as, you know, they've grown, me and my wife both graduated from Syracuse, so they've grown up kind of inundated with Syracuse. You know, Malcolm has been up to the games a lot of times, especially since I started working with ESPN Syracuse. And so, of course, they all love it. But, you know, no, it's whatever is best for them and where they want to go to. So, you know, I'm trying to be impartial, trying to.
Well, it's just been a pleasure to speak with you. Etan Thomas is the author of the new book, Police Brutality and White Supremacy, The Fight Against American Traditions. And he gives us a lot to think about in the book. Etan, thank you so much for your time and stay safe.
Okay, thanks a lot again for having me.
And you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.